Maybe I was talking too high. Now, another part of my pedagogy is I tend to fly high and then come back down to the ground a little bit. All right. Okay. Who wants to say what they think the piece is about? Somebody read it. Well, yes, sir.
Well, I think he was talking about how the evolution of thought and philosophy came about through logic and memory rather than logical contemplation.
Logic and memory, right? So there's a kind of narrative, mythopoeic origin to philosophy as well as the logical and conceptual, right? Okay, that's pretty good. All right, awesome. What was the general reaction to this piece, those people who had a chance to read it? What did you think about it? How does it fit in with the two introductions to the two different collections of metaphysics that Bob had you read? He had you read an introduction to like the Oxford Handbook of Metaphysics and an introduction to the Routledge Handbook of Metaphysics, I think. So how does that compare? How does Dewey compare to that? How does he fit into what y'all read there? Does he at all?
No, I wouldn't say. He kind of like starts off in the very, very, very beginning, but the other guy starts off directly from the 20th century.
Okay. So for a lot of metaphysicians today, metaphysics basically begins after the scientific revolution. Very late into the scientific revolution, late 19th century, early 20th century, when analytic philosophers began thinking about metaphysics and whether they care about metaphysics or what the metaphysical might be. Who wants to give me a definition? God, this is horrible. Who wants to give me a definition of metaphysics? Well, let's give me a definition of metaphysics. Judy, you gonna be my only top voice today? There's no, you know, in philosophy, I'll give you my definition of philosophy. My definition of philosophy is the willingness to be uncertain and the will to ask questions. Okay? Sometimes you admit that you don't know what metaphysics is, and then you try to find somebody who might know what metaphysics is. But here's the deal. We live in the United States of America. 21st century. Every single one of you has a definition of metaphysics because you run across metaphysics all the time. Whether you have a New Age definition of metaphysics or a Christian definition of metaphysics or whatever the case may be, everybody in here should be able to tell me what you think metaphysics is. And yes, you could be very well wrong, or yes, you could be very well narrow. But it's impossible for you to reach the age you're at and probably not have some kind of like at least poor definition of metaphysics. Yes, ma'am.
I think you have to say that inside like metaphysics, question mark, a claim which is undeniable if philosophy leads man to prove an intuition of a reality beyond that open to day by day life in a special sense.
Okay, now then, how would you take that and turn it into, what's your name again? You got your name tag up, I'm sure, but I can't see it. Elizabeth? Elizabeth, how would you take that and turn that into an Elizabethan, not a 17th century, but an Elizabethan, your own definition?
So that we need philosophy to just show what is extraordinary about our...
Okay, so let me get different markers that are visible. I'll pay for it later when I'm trying to erase, I'm sure, but... So metaphysics is a kind of philosophizing, right? I use pi for philosophy because it never stops. So metaphysics is a kind of philosophizing that gives us what? An intuition
of reality beyond.
Okay, an intuition of reality beyond. Beyond being, beyond what? Beyond our senses or beyond our everyday?
Beyond that open to day by day
Okay, beyond common sense or day by day. Like beyond day by day. Day by day life. And that's a nice definition, actually. What? Okay, and the special sciences. So we could take this definition and we can really kind of run with it, play around with it in a lot of ways. First of all, the word that stands out to me that's extremely important is this word. That's why I put it in quotation marks and underlined it, and I now have put it in a rectangle to say that it's important. It's important because beyond is what meta means in Greek, right? Meta is that which comes after or that which is beyond, all right? So, meta. Now, I'm sure Bob told you you read somewhere the accident of how metaphysics becomes metaphysics as a name, as a technical term, right? Having to do with Aristotle's writings, that it happened to be the book that is one book beyond the physics. And that's the only reason it's called metaphysics. He never uses the term metaphysics. Aristotle talks about first philosophy, meaning a philosophy of the first, of the, in Greek, arche, in Latin, principe. And you'll see this come up again and again and again. Newton doesn't say that he does metaphysics, but Newton does the principe mathematica. Right? Which is what? Which is the first principles of mathematics. But what does the word mathematic itself mean in Latin and Greek? Mathematics in Latin and Greek doesn't mean math. It actually means knowledge. So Aristotle and everybody after Aristotle who does what you would call strict metaphysics in the history of philosophy, they generally say what they're doing, they call it first philosophy. You know, looking for the principe, for the arche in Greek. All right? And you actually see from the very beginning of the history of philosophy that philosophizing, insofar as it's seeking after something, begins a lot of times by seeking for the arche. Okay? The arche, the first. The ancient of days, if you will, if I can use some Judeo-Christian lingo. Looking for the arche, the first. So Thales, who here has had ancient philosophy? What's Thales say the arche is? What's the first? What is everything made of?
Oh, Lord.
Oh, you don't remember? Not the Lord.
It's been 10 years.
Yeah.
Was Thales the one who said it was water?
Yes. So Thales says the arche is water. But now you look at stuff. Now how you know that he's kind of, in one sense, he's a natural philosopher in the sense that he's talking about the way the world is and how things are made up, right? On the other hand, he's going directly to this meta beyond the day-by-day life in the special sciences, right? Or the special investigations. Because this does not look like, to me, it's made up of water. Even that it's not cold enough to be ice, right? But Thales says everything is water, right? But then, so then you could go ahead and you can say, well, yeah, but Keith, you know, we know what water is. Water's just a regular old material substance. We know water. So in the history of philosophy, where does metaphysics really get started? Well, actually, the person who comes after Thales, who said it was water, and who we can also say was maybe possibly a student, definitely a friend of Thales, is a gentleman named Anaximander. Do you remember Anaximander's arche? It's a little hard. It's more technical. It's actually more metaphysical.
Is he the one who believed it was the Aperon?
Very good. Yeah, you got a good memory there. He called it Whoops, I did it wrong, didn't I? He didn't say, the Apeiron didn't say Anaximander is the basis of all things. Anaximander said the Apeiron is. These little mistakes are how philosophy gets befuddled over time. Okay. He said it was the Apeiron. Do you remember what Apeiron means?
Nothingness, the infinite.
The infinite. The deep, you know, the without limit. Now, as soon as a creature that is nothing but limit conditions, right? There is very little about us that's not limited. Even our imagination can only go so far. Everybody think of a square circle. See? Even imagination has its limits. There's nothing about us that's not limited. But this man, Anaximander, 2,600 years ago, posits something that I would definitely say is very beyond day-by-day life, very beyond even the special sciences. Because the special sciences, even if we're just talking about the way we do science today, which is far beyond how they did investigations 2,700 years ago, special sciences generally are special investigations of mathematicoi, of people who want to know, of people who want to do inquiries and investigations. These kinds of investigations are always about what's limited, because it's always taking measurements. The limited always has a measurement. The without limit, the unlimited, the unbounded, the indefinite doesn't have any measurements, has no limits. So we definitely, by the second, if not Thales, by the second philosopher in the history of Western thinking, Anaximander, we had entered into what you might call metaphysics. That everything arises from that which itself has no limitations. The Apeiron. But we're kind of far away from Dewey. Dewey himself thought that it was a waste of time to read Greek philosophy. Did you know that? Yeah. He's actually one of the reasons, in one sense, that classical philosophy takes a back seat over in the United States of America. Pragmatists generally are not interested in metaphysics. And it's not to say that Dewey said that all these people are not worthwhile, or they're not worth studying, or there's absolutely nothing worthwhile in Plato or Aristotle or any of these ancient philosophers. But he did kind of poo-poo the idea to enough of an extent people used him as an excuse to not really go to keep getting people to read ancient philosophy. All right. But getting back to old Dewey here, professor of philosophy, Columbia University. That's an officially smart place, as Bob would say. All right. So this was originally written in 1920. Man differs from the lower animals because he preserves his past experiences. We already lost people who don't like to make a distinction between human beings and animals. A lot of people don't like that nowadays. They don't like to say that animals don't think or animals don't reason, or that animals are on a lower scale than human beings. That's a de facto given for Dewey. So we already lost half the audience. Oh well. The other half stick up with it. What happened in the past is lived again in memory. Memory is a really awesome power. It is an amazing power. Memory is an amazing power. Look at what we've been able to do with human memory. The very first thing I did was just suddenly bluff off. I asked you if you remembered something from ancient philosophy. But more importantly than that, because human beings have learned tricks like writing, right? We've extended human memory back as far as we can find ways to write things down and decipher them. There, I can say this. I'm not sure that there's any animal that does that. Maybe whale songs are long, 10,000-year-long histories, for all we know, of what whales have been up to in different oceans. Okay? Maybe there's a way that elephants and the way that they wander around the plains of Africa and, you know, they go this way and they dance that way and they do these kind of things. Maybe inside of all that somewhere they have a 50,000-year-long history that they keep alive. But I can't figure out whether, you know, I myself have not been able to figure out whether or not that's actually the case. But I can look at human beings and I can say that we have done something really amazing with the ability to remember. Okay? And memory plays a huge role in every single thing you're doing. Right? Because you're remembering how to write right now without thinking about it. But you're doing it because you have physical memory and you have habitual memory. All these things, you know, if you begin to play the piano, do you play the piano because you could play the piano from the moment you were born or because you practice and you practice and you practice till you have body memory? And it brings that stuff back. You don't think so?
I'm having a lot of memories of a lot of piano lessons all of a sudden.
Oh, yeah. See, and there's also unpleasant memories. I didn't really like my piano lessons that much either. Yeah. Well, an interesting thing now, but see, I was reading this because my mom is beginning to lose her memory, but she has a cracking memory. So I can ask her, do you remember that time that you went to pull taffy with friends on your daddy on your second date? And she can describe the exact scene to me for hours and hours and hours. So a lot of times what's interesting in that sense that it's horrible, but the intriguing issue is a short-term memory is the big problem with people who have a lot of Alzheimer's, or they'll get caught or lost inside of the memories that are the most important, right? Yeah. And this is very true. And a lot of what Dewey's saying here actually parallels the experiences of people like, you know, my mom or my Aunt Marie or somebody like that. When they would get upset, they would start focusing on something they couldn't let go of in the present. And one of the best ways to get them to let go of it is to say, hey, tell me about when you met Uncle Ray before he went off to World War II. And then they break out of this loop they're in, and they go back to something that is important to them. Right? But yeah, this is a key component of what it means to be human, that we have not only our habitual memory. And habitual memory would be all the things that you learn to do so that you don't even have to worry about thinking. But the words used in here once or twice, that we have this incredible episodic memory. The habitual memory is the stuff that happens because you learn how to do it. Walking, even breathing, maybe that's not it. That's autonomic. So we have autonomic functions, which you might call the deep tissue memory. Then we have habitual memory, which is we develop habits and practices, and we just keep doing it over and over and over again till we're able to do it without thinking about it. And then we have this thing, episodic memory. Now, it's very interesting. Pete Gunner, who was the first chair of our department and is a scholar of Henri Bergson, kind of a contemporary, French contemporary of Dewey's. Bergson did a lot of work on memory, did a lot of work on how memory works and what memory is. And he also points out these ideas of the habitual memory and the episodic memory and where episodic memory is at. There's been a lot of studies that have been done of the human brain. And there's that special sciences thing going on. There's been a lot of studies done of the human brain, and some of the greatest people who study memory have been able to find in the brain where habitual memory happens. But they're having trouble finding where episodic memory happens. And so now, and this is a metaphysical notion of mind now we're fixing to move into. Now there are people who are putting forward the notion that episodic memory is quantum. That it doesn't happen in a specific place. That it happens through entanglements and singularities that flow out, and it's a very interesting thing, because what happens in episodic memory that's also very important to some of the stuff that Dewey's saying inside of this piece. is that, and this is a phenomenological point as well as a pragmatist point, phenomenology, that's something y'all are going to definitely be studying a lot of, accounting for how things appear to consciousness. It's a phenomenological point. When you revive, to use Dewey's terminology, when you revive a memory in your mind, it inhabits the present. So episodic memory, if you do trace it inside, if you do studies of people having episodic memory with a CT scan going on, the parts of the brain that you'd expect to be active when someone is literally perceiving something with their senses right in front of them are the parts that begin to light up. Because, now here's the phenomenological point, because consciousness does not distinguish between the perceived and the imagined. In the sense that to see something in consciousness, to experience something in consciousness, whether it's imagined or whether it's perceived, is just as real to consciousness. This is Edmund Husserl's phenomenology that becomes the basis for the thinking of a number of people in the 20th century, including Martin Heidegger, Carl Jaspers, influences Jose Ortega y Gasset, and a whole slew of what we call continental philosophers. So yeah, memory. Each occurrence is charged with echoes and reminiscences of what has gone on before. A reminder of other things. Look at this language. Play with language. I want to encourage you to play with language. Language is absolutely useless to you if you treat it like it's sacrosanct. Language has to be played with. You have to figure out, right? So each occurrence is charged with echoes and reminiscences of what has gone before, where each event is a reminder. Don't go, something will happen when you start doing continental philosophy is everybody becomes hyphen happy. So you got to be careful about that. But you do have to put that in there. What does it mean to remind? It means to bring back to mind. Right? When you get into doing the Heidegger, I especially encourage you to play with the language. Get an etymology dictionary. There's a nice one, etymonline.com, that you can just use really quickly. Play around with the words a little bit, right? He lives not like the beasts of the field in a world of merely physical things, but in a world of signs and symbols. And it's through these signs and symbols that we bring our memories back. And then the stronger those memories are, the more impact those things have on our lives, the more those things become regular signs and regular symbols. Okay? Whoops. So, remembering, right? Here's Keith. Here's my first grade teacher, Mrs. Willis. Here's my first grade reader, Tip the Dog. Remember. I remember. I bring back these members. The memory is a remembering. It's a bringing back a body to myself, right? I stretch back to 1970 when Mrs. Willis was teaching me how to read, and we were reading Tip the Dog and His Crazy Little Adventures. And my mom, actually, not that long ago, I was visiting in Abilene, my mom took out all these books that belonged to me when I was a kid. And she said, I want the girls' kids to have this, or I want the church kids to have these. And I was like, they can have everything except for Tip the Dog. Right? So we still have that book. And I was flipping through it, and I had very strong memories of Mrs. Willis sitting next to me, helping me read. Because I was already farther advanced than a few of the people in my class, because my mom taught me how to read when I was three. But she was helping me like sound out other kinds of bigger words and things, right? And I had a really strong memory of that. And that's a remembering. It's a bringing the places, the things back together again, right? But this is the phenomenological point. This is the point that Dewey's really getting at, that it's a retaining, it's a retention. That word tension, tend, tension, retend, intend, protend, obtend, extend. These are all very extremely important words, and the word basically means to stretch. So that when we talk about the world, when Descartes talks about the world and says that it's a world of extension, he means that it stretches out. And to be in the world is to stretch out. Perception is about stretching out. It's about touching, stretching out and touching something. Memory is about retending. It's about stretching backward. Man, humanity, humankind, let's pick whatever word we want to do here. They remember, preserve, and record their experiences, our experiences. We remember, preserve, and record our experiences. And so memory then is about what interests us. There's more of those crazy words that we should play with. Interest. To be between, within. When something interests you, it catches you up inside of it. You're not, if you're interested in something, you're very rarely, like I always thought the thing they did with Mr. Spock never really made a whole lot of sense, and then I started kind of thinking about how he made a distinction between fascinating and interesting. And actually it's because interesting was something that began to catch him and pull him into what they were taught, what they were looking at. Whereas fascinating is just something that made him stop in the distance and go, Yeah.
What if you tend to be interested in something?
Well, you can always say about that. You may not be in the, you may tend to be interested in NFL football, but hopefully right now that's not what you're thinking about. So your tending is always how you lean, is always how you what direction you're stretched in. It's a good question. So what interests you is what catches you up. It's where you are. If you're really interested in it, that's where you are. This is the very important aspect of what he's talking about, though. The primary life, what it adds, it interests us. It's what it adds to the present, right? It fills the present up and gives it, because you may be having just a boring day. Some of you sitting here may be just absolutely bored shitless with me. And you're actually thinking about some better times that you used to have in classes, when classes were still fun. Right? But you add something to the present, you get out of, you know, you're into, it's what interests you, it's what catches you up. And then if there's nothing else going on, if something else, it adds to this present. When you reflect on the past, you bring the past forward through memory. So primary life and memory is emotional rather than intellectual and practical. Even if you remember something intellectual, like learning how to read better, I don't remember that because of the intellectual content. I barely remember that thing happening until I got the book in my hands and I was interested again in what was going on, and I remembered Miss Willis, and this woman had an incredible influence on the rest of my life. I remember she's the only teacher when I was a kid, and you could do this a lot when you're a kid, and maybe you're more prone to do it when you're in first grade. She's the only teacher when I was getting ready to leave for the summer. I started crying because I didn't think I'd ever see her again. So attached to her, right? It's emotional or something. And that definitely is the aspect of the episodical character. Right? The things we remember often have that emotional charge, that emotional patina to it. Remember the first time that you actually were madly in love with somebody and that song was playing on the radio, or it was playing on someone's, I guess when y'all were kids, iPods, or it was, you know, playing somehow somewhere. Certainly wasn't on MTV by the time y'all were kids. It was playing somewhere. Right, and in one sense, it, because of your interest in the person and the aptness of the song, the interest became conjoined. And now that you're 22 years old or 24 years old, you suddenly have these very vivid memories when you hear certain songs. Very vivid memories, body heat, smells, things like that. Right, it's because memory is emotional. There's something about music, this ability to make music, that really binds quite well to the way that we think and the way that we remember. That's why also being able to put something in a song helps you remember it better. But another thing that's interesting about memory is how memory brings into the present, brings into to the world that we're in now, those things that could have happened to us that were quite dangerous or we're quite sad, and allows us to deal with them, to reflect on them, to share them with other people. And you'll often see sometimes the ones that made you the most mad, made you the most sad, you felt were the most dangerous, 20 years down the line you start talking about them and all you can do is laugh as they come forward, right? So this memory has all the excitement of the combat without its danger and anxiety. So he's, of course, talking here about how slowly over time human beings evolved this ability of memory, to took this ability of memory to make it something really powerful as a tool that ends up becoming how we organize the world, right? How we think about the world, how we draw the world together through what we remember, okay? All right. One last little thing, and then let's stop and conversate. So now memory not only becomes this power to relive, to revive, to retain back, retain into the present something of great import and interest to us, something of emotional impact, okay? The time of practical experience, man exists from moment to moment, preoccupied with the task of the moment. As he resurveys all the moments in thought, a drama emerges with the beginning, a middle, and the movement toward the climax of achievement or defeat. So this power of memory turns into also the power of account. The power to account for, the power to narrate. And here we get to the reason why you started off, I would say you started off with you started off with that Oxford Handbook of Metaphysics, the intro by What's His Ass and Lou, and then you started, and then you did the Routledge Handbook of Metaphysics. Which both of which basically start with late 19th century, early 20th century, and they don't really care about what came before that. And that has a lot to do with the fact of the influence of the special sciences upon the way metaphysics is done and what we consider to be real and unreal. And the fact that by the time one of the aspects that demarcates this kind of philosophizing that's concerned with making sure what we say jibes with the scientific is that it becomes science as accuracy, or it becomes philosophy as accuracy, only saying accurate things, only saying valid, logically valid things. Since man revives his past experience because of the interest added to what would otherwise be the emptiness of present leisure, the primitive life of memory is one of fancy and imagination rather than of accurate recollection. Of fancy and imagination. This word phenomena comes from the Greek word phanestai, which is also the word that gives us fantasy and fancy. Imaginative thinking is fantastic, not in the sense that it's whoa, that could never happen. Sometimes, very often, imaginative is totally fantastic. Like Star Wars is really more science fantasy than science fiction. Right? Because it's about imagining a galaxy where creatures have discovered that they are capable of becoming one with a force beyond the day by day and the investigative sciences. And that is, and the interesting aspect, of course, of that is that as it becomes a habitual memory for someone who trains in using it, it's accomplished through the ability to imagine. I said at the beginning of the class that imagination itself has its limits. You can't imagine a square circle. It just won't happen. I mean, you can try. I mean, you can get caught in the deal where I say imagine a square circle, and then I just come back to you 10 years later, and you've been trying.
You can also, you know, pull the whole language is arbitrary anyways. So.
You could do language is arbitrary anyways, and the issue with you, Keith, is that you're not imagining enough to realize that a square is really a circle anyway, so that's...
No.
It's just a circle with edges. But yeah, exactly. So that's you have to like kind of know what the play with the language and know how these things work. But imagination is extremely important aspect of what we are. Now let's say look at Jessica's water bottle. Okay. Everybody who can see Jessica's water bottle, as you look at it, there's a number of things that happen simultaneously with your along with your perception. First of all, not everybody can see it very well, if at all. It's blocked for some people. So you're just trusting that I have it. And I say, look at Jessica's water bottle, and you trust me, if you can't see it, that it's there. But even when I say, look at Jessica's water bottle and you can't see it, you got a water bottle that kind of pops up into your head. So you have a perception of her water bottle, but you only see your water bottle from whatever angle you actually can experience it, either completely imaginatively because you can't see it, or just from whatever angle you happen to be at, right? But at the same time that that perception is going on, there are a number of other things that have happened simultaneously that you don't think about. In other words, if you take and you deconstruct the act of me saying to you, look at Jessica's water bottle and you doing it, you have, first of all, remember what a water bottle is so that you know where to look. Secondly, you've perceived and kind of watched my body language. You've made a judgment that I'm talking about Jessica. You can't see Jessica's name, and maybe you don't know who the hell Jessica is, right? I could have just as easily meant Samia. Samia's water bottle, right? Although it's a Gatorade bottle, isn't it? Well, whatever, her bottle. All right, but at any rate, so, you know, you made a judgment. So you've perceived, you've remembered, you've made a judgment. The water bottle itself is a conception, right? It's an idea. You understand what water bottles are. So, I mean, you know, think about that. And then more than that, it's not just the person, it's not actually just the person who when I said, look at Jessica's water bottle, just had a water bottle imaginatively pop into their head because they couldn't see the water bottle. Everybody here has used your imagination to give the water bottle depth because you can only see the aspect of the water bottle that you have privy to in your perception, but you know that water bottles have more going on than just the one little bit that you can see, so your imagination has provided everything necessary for the water bottle to be a full experience. But all this shit happened, boom, 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 boom. Right, my ability to actually, and I can go through all that with a little more finesse than I just did. My ability to talk about it is definitely a lot longer than the nanosecond it actually takes for you to go through and do it. This is the flow of experience, the flow of the life world. In the ancient world, now I've just given you some special science, phenomenological, philosophical, blah, 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 about all that, to use technical language. The real point here isn't that you actually have, like with the person who couldn't see the water bottle, that you actually have an exact collection of the facts of the water bottle. That's not the kind of thing that originally mattered when we were remembering or we were imagining and making use of. Fancy and imagination bring memory to bear to create narratives, and it doesn't matter whether they're accurate recollections. And one of the ways that y'all will be examining this notion or the importance of this idea of accurate recollection versus imaginative and fanciful engagement, when you get to Martin Heidegger, you're going to start, at one point, you're going to begin talking about aletheia, which is the Greek word for truth. This is the Greek word for truth. And it actually, means unforgotten. So in one sense, the truth is the not forgotten, the unforgettable, the discovered, the revealed, the unveiled. But over the course of Western metaphysical history, truth took on the character of Latin veritas. So this is Latin. This is Greek. This is Latin. Took on the character of Latin veritas, and this is very important because this character of truth is the truth that Romans expected to come out in a trial. So it was supposed to be as accurately recollective as it possibly could be. But here, in what Heidegger will want to emphasize is that sometimes there are things that are caught up in any thinking, any narrative, any conceptualization, any philosophizing that are forgotten about, that people didn't know hitched a ride onto it, that people had chosen to stop paying attention to, even though it's there, so that this importance of the importance of memory and the power of retention here to stretch back to, it's not that these kinds of, here we say, truth as accurate. It's not that these things are counterposed to each other. It's that this is broader than this one. This veritas is a kind of aletheia, but aletheia, not all aletheia is veritas. The unforgettable, the unforgotten, the revelatory is as truthing, right? Can sometimes be a kind of accuracy, but often it's not concerned with accuracy. It's concerned with revealing what's there, with elucidation. And these ideas are in one sense find themselves at odds with how philosophy is done and how philosophers actually look at the way that people have put forward metaphysical ideas or have put forward metaphysical conceptions or narratives or whatever. And I think that this is a good place for me to stop and us to discuss for a little while. Early humanity, left to themselves, lived in a world of memories, which was a world of suggestions. A suggestion differs from a recollection that no attempt is made to test its correctness. And when I get to this point, and I want us to, this is how you should read Dewey, but this is definitely how you should read Heidegger. Hopefully, yeah, these kind of actually erase. The tendency of students when they begin college and they're in college and they've even worked with some people who have drawn this into their heads a little more. Do this. Since man revives his past experience because of the interest added to what would otherwise be the emptiness of present leisure, the primitive life of memory is one of fancy and imagination rather than of accurate recollection. It's to slowly read sentences carefully and go from one sentence to the next sentence. And that's wrong. That is wrong. Do not read that way. You should never read that way. That is not the way to start reading anything. When you're doing philosophy, the first thing you want to do is look for the suggestions. Now, I will admit that contemporary philosophy, which has become enslaved to the essay, right, has a lot of little things you can do to get through a text to see what the text is talking about, right? When you're reading Heidegger's Being and Time, you do want, at one point, you want to go to that thing and you want to take it with great care. On the third or fourth reading of it, on the first or second reading, you want to run through that shit. Why? Because you want to get the gesture. You don't want to get the details. Right? If I were to draw Jacob.
Judah. Why'd I call you Jacob?
Oh, I remember one. Never mind. Okay. Judah. If I were to draw Judah and I started doing this. Okay, let me start with the hair. Yeah. And then just start drawing all the details. That's not how you're taught to draw. You have to kind of like see the art of philosophy. And the art of philosophy is not starting with the details. The details will slowly but surely reveal themselves. The art of philosophy, just like the art of drawing, is starting with the gesture. I'm not a very good drawer. Starting with the gesture and then making your way to the details. Right? Then you go back and you look for the details of what it is that you want to put in. You always start with the gesture that captures Judas sitting in metaphysics. You always start with the gesture that captures what Heidegger or Dewey or whatever are up to. So there's a lot to be learned from Dewey thinking about this origins, the changing conception of philosophy by locating things in our connection to memory, and then reaching this point where we understand that a world of suggestions. A suggestion differs from a recollection that no attempt is made to test its correctness. You're looking for, first, the gestures. Then the secondary gestures. Then you can start filling in the first details. And slowly but surely, you'll get to a point where the details become so apparent that you can turn around and you can tell people very easily what the details are. Right? That's what you want to do. That requires you to take pieces like the Dewey or like the Heidegger, read across them really quickly. You won't understand it at first, but your mind is taking in a lot more than you realize. You take all that in and you kind of grab the gesture, and then you go back and then you start working on those details. And every time you go back to it, you fill in more details. A lot of you have been taught to go directly for those details. And when you start reading somebody like Martin Heidegger or Aristotle or Plato, you're going to get lost in the details real fast. I wasn't lost in the details, but let me relate to you a story. I once spent an entire summer doing nothing but reading and rereading the first book of the Republic. An entire summer. First weekend in June to the last weekend in August. I read it, and I reread it, and I reread it, and I reread it. And by the time I got finished by the time I got to the end of August, not only had I read that book countless number of times, I had read all these books that suddenly began to open up to tell me more just about what that one book is talking about. I could do 4 lectures on the first 5 lines of Plato's Republic. And everything that's packed into those 5 lines. You would get lost in the details. Do not get lost in the details. That's not your job right now. Your job is to learn how to begin thinking. And learning how to begin thinking is to learn how to connect your memory and your imagination with the stuff that you're reading. Right? To find the suggestions. And that means going back to something. Bob is going to ask you to read something one time. That's when you're going to get the suggestion of what's going on. He's going to ask you to read something a second time. That's when you begin to see that you got the suggestion right and maybe one or two of the details come out. He's going to ask you to read it a third time. That's when there's going to be a few details that you might be able to do something with. If you go back to it a fourth or a fifth or a sixth time, there'll be details that you can really work with. You can swing with, as Bob says. Okay. All right, I'm going to stop there, and then we'll pick up from there. But I want us to talk for a little bit.